What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, look at that. We made it to Friday. What do you know? Hey, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, hey, we're here for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then once you get that response, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email if you'd rather do that. The address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski is our phone screener, Rich Jesse handling social media. If you would like to ask us a question via YouTube, well, we're streaming there right now, live. Look, I'm waving at you. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please. And then Rich will shoot that to us here in the studio, and we're off to the races. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
Very well. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right, thanks.
Weekend plans for you?
Well, you know, I got infinite lists that I got to run down and accomplish. So it's going to be the accomplishment of lists.
We have this stupid tradition in our family. It involves a 3x5 card, and I pull out a new 3x5 card every Saturday morning, and with a cup of coffee, I start listing everything that I would like to do over the weekend, either with my wife or on my own that I have to tackle. And fortunately, I'm able to, I don't think I've ever crossed them all off, but I sure make a good, valiant effort.
Well, fantastic.
Here is a text that came in yesterday at the very end of the show, so we could not answer it on yesterday's program. This is from Jane. Jane says, is it appropriate to have masses said for Protestant relatives, even if they did not agree with the teachings of the Catholic Church?
Yep. Pray away.
Yeah.
No prayer is ever wasted.
We do it.
How about it?
We do it in our family. I think, you know, we've got 36 family members in Australia. I don't know how many members in this country. I don't think any of them are Catholic at this
point. So here's what you don't have to do. So let's say that, you know, you have a Protestant relative who dies.
Yes.
And their extremely anti-Catholic spouse is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to send a mass card to the remaining spouse to explain that you're having, you know, a suite of Gregorian masses said for the repose of the soul of their loved one. That is probably not going to comfort in those circumstances.
Probably not.
You have the masses said, but you don't have to be provocative about it.
Very good. Jane, thank you so much for your text. Sorry we couldn't tackle it yesterday, but as I mentioned earlier, the program was ending, so we just couldn't do it. Glad we could do it today. Here's a question from David, who says, Dr. Anders, during a gospel study discussion, the question was asked if we are permitted in our daily lives to say the name represented by the letters YHWH, which necessitates the introduction of vowels. A person in our group found some authority that the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments issued a letter in 2008 that directed the name of God in the form of the Tetragrammaton cannot be used or said in the liturgy. Rather, the translation that should be used is the word Lord. So my question remains whether or not we as Catholics are permitted to or even should say the name represented by the letters YHWH. Thank you, David.
Here it is, Vatican Directives on the Use of the Name of God.
You found it.
I found it.
Okay.
Yeah, so the letter does not forbid Catholics ever from reading, using, or speaking the name of God in the form Yahweh, but is addressing its liturgical use.
Ah, so liturgically.
Yeah, liturgically, you are not to, you're not to pronounce it. And I think that's probably out of sensitivity to our Jewish brothers and sisters
okay.
who don't use it and would find that offensive.
Sure, sure. David, thank you for your email. Here's one from Jaime. Why do Catholics not celebrate Hanukkah if it is in our Bible? Thank you. Love your show. Jaime.
This is going to seem like a cheap answer, but because it's not a Catholic liturgical feast.
Hello.
You know, I mean, so the, you know, the Catholic liturgy is something that developed organically over time. And, of course, the origins of Catholic liturgy are principally in the institution of the Mass given to us by Jesus.
Uh-huh.
And so the first Catholic feast, of course, is the Feast of Sunday because Christ instituted it directly.
Mm-hmm.
And then very early on, Christians began to celebrate Easter annually. And we know this because in the second century, there were great big stinking fights in the church about when to celebrate Easter, what date to use to celebrate Easter. And it was the Easter controversy, and it nearly split the church in the second century.
Really?
Yeah, but it's but the Easter, very, very early celebration in the church's history. And I'm sorry to say that among second and third century writers, even late first century writers, there was a real keen awareness of a felt need to differentiate Christian liturgical practice from Jewish liturgical practice. And in fact, the fact that Jews did something on a particular day of the week, that fact alone was almost enough to dissuade certain Christians from doing it. Right? There was a period in the church's history where it wasn't clear that Judaism and Christianity were different things.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And as they became more recognizably distinct traditions, both sides were at pains to kind of differentiate themselves from one another. And Judaism developed sometimes in ways that were consciously and conscientiously anti-Christian, and Christianity developed in ways that were sometimes consciously and conscientiously anti-Jewish. And in fact, I mean, I think in the Didache, you can actually see passages that say, well, you know, we Christians fast on this day of the week and this day of the week and this day of the week. Not like those hypocrites over there that fast on that day of the week and that day of the week and that day of the week. I mean, it's that cheap, right?
Wow.
And so I think, I'm not sure when Jews began to celebrate Hanukkah, but it would have been post, you know, AD.
Okay.
And that in the early centuries, that alone would have been enough reason for some, you know, very anti-Jewish Christian not to do it.
Jaime, thank you so much for your email. Lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Sometimes, actually quite often, on Fridays, the phone tends to fill up rather quickly. People want to get that answer, you know, before the weekend is here. Well, the weekend is basically here right now. So I would recommend calling early in the hour, 833-288-EWTN. You know, you don't want to have to sit on hold for X number of minutes and then find out the show's over. That would not be good. 833-288-EWTN. Here's something else that is good, carrying the EWTN app on your phone. It is fantastic. You can enjoy EWTN live TV and radio streams like this program, audio and video on demand like this program, EWTN news, program schedules, prayers, devotionals. It is all right there on the absolutely free EWTN app. Download it today by going to EWTNapps.com, EWTNapps.com. That's available for your Apple device or your Android device. It is there for you. And again, absolutely free at EWTNapps.com. All right, phone lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Here's an email from David. When in 2 Peter 3:15, it starts talking about someone distorting Paul's letter to their own destruction, is it plausible that someone had already started reading them in a way that resembles the Protestant approach, or is there another interpretation? Thanks so much for your work, David.
Yeah, thanks. So I think that it is not only plausible, I think that it's likely,
okay.
But we have to qualify. We have to qualify. So there are some peculiarities to the Protestant interpretation of St. Paul that have no precedent at all in Christian tradition. In particular, the idea of imputed righteousness. And that's really where the metaphysical nub of the matter between Catholics and Protestants is, how is it that Christ's death saves us? And the Catholic position is that through the death of Christ, our moral lives are transformed, that grace comes in and changes us from the inside out so that we effectively love God and neighbor. And the Protestant position at the end of the day is that righteousness is imputed to you and you're accounted righteous for Jesus' sake, even if your internal moral life is not sufficiently renovated, right? So that's where the faith alone business comes in with Protestantism. And that peculiar element of the theory of justification in Protestantism is a novelty of the 16th century, and you don't find precedent for it earlier in the tradition, okay? That being said, there were readings of Paul that were antinomian, all right? Now, without going all the way to Lutheran justification by faith, antinomianism is an antipathy to the law, and, you know, like a rejection of law. And antinomianism can be more or less severe. I mean, you could have a kind of anti-Jewish antinomianism that simply rejects the Mosaic Code, or you could have a more thoroughgoing antinomianism that rejects the principle of law as such and advocates kind of libertarianism. And the second century early Christian writer Marcion was, you know, Lutherans sometimes like to think of Marcion as kind of proto-Luther, although what he held was not what Luther held. And Marcion's position was that, based on his reading of St. Paul, was that not just the Mosaic Law, but the whole Old Testament legislation and dispensation, including the Old Testament God, were all kaput, null and void, and evil and to be thrown away. And so he purged his New Testament of any Judaizing elements. His canon of the Bible consisted primarily in the letters of Paul, and he posited that there were basically two gods, a God of the Old Testament, a God of the New, a Jewish God and a Christian God, an evil God and a good God. And the Lutheran liberal historian Adolf von Harnack, who was a great historian of dogma, wrote a book about Marcion, in which Marcion appears as kind of a great hero and a proto-Luther. Right. Luther, I think, would not have appreciated the compliment, right? Because Luther was no Marcionite, and Luther definitely didn't hold that view of the Old Testament.
Okay.
But so I do think there were people who were reading Paul in ways that were destructive and dangerous and antinomian and anti-Jewish. I don't think that they were reading him exactly the way Luther read him.
David, thank you so much for your email. That opens up I'll tell you what, why don't we just go to the phones right now at 833-288-EWTN. We're going to begin with Billy, a first-time caller. He is driving through Kansas listening on Covenant Radio. Hello, Billy. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes. I'm not a practicing Catholic. I'm interested in the Catholic religion, and I've been to the Catholic Church on occasion. But my question is, I am divorced from my ex-wife, and the reason we got a divorce was adultery on her part. So my question is, what is the Catholic religion stance on remarriage after a divorce?
Yeah, great question. Really appreciate it. Okay, so there are some nuances here, okay? So hang with me. The question of the legitimacy of divorce after adultery is a major line in the sand between Protestantism and Catholicism. And it was in the 16th century when the Protestant Reformation took place. One of the major arguments that the Reformers used, the Protestants used, was that they would allow divorce and remarriage after adultery. And in Calvin's Geneva in 16th century Switzerland, we have the first recorded instances of Protestant divorce and remarriage after adultery, right? And the Catholic Church always maintained that adultery as such does not sever the permanence of a valid marriage. All right, but that's not the end of the story for you, so hold with me, okay? So Protestants said, yeah, divorce, I mean, adultery, that's a done deal. That ends the marriage. If the parties want to end it, it's done. And then you're totally free to remarry. Catholic position was, no. If it's a valid marriage, even adultery does not do it in. You're still married, okay? However, here are the two caveats. First of all, the Catholic Church they are not idiots in the Catholic Church. And they understand that coming home and sharing a bed with somebody who's cheating on you is impossible. Like, it's not just difficult. Like, you can't do that.
Can't do it.
You just can't do it. And so, right off the bat, they allow for civil mm-hmm. divorce in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't yet gotten to the question of remarriage. So divorce is absolutely allowable in cases of adultery.
Okay.
Because it's intolerable. You can't live under the same roof as somebody who's cheating on you. Have not yet addressed the question of remarriage. So now let's get to the question of remarriage. Here's the Catholic position. Remember, I already mentioned that if you're validly married, then you're stuck. You're there till the end of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the loophole for you. Lots of people who think they're validly married are not validly married. Okay? And here's one angle of approach for you. I am guessing, because this would be the case for most Protestants, that when you entered into marriage as a Protestant, you had this idea in your head. If my wife ever cheats on me, then that ends the marriage. That's what most Protestants are taught. Now, you didn't want her to cheat on you, but you had the idea, if she cheats, then that's a done deal and the marriage is over. Well, here's how the Catholic Church looks at that. When you got married as a Protestant, what you promised to do was to say, I'll stay with you till death do us part unless you commit adultery. So you had a loophole there in what you promised. Even if he didn't say those words, that was your intent. What you actually intended, based on your understanding of marriage, was, I'll stay with you forever, as long as you don't commit adultery. But if the day comes when you commit adultery, then we're done. Catholic Church looks at that and says, you're not actually married. You're not actually married. What you committed to was something other than the Catholic doctrine of marriage. And so you would be free to remarry, presumably, because you never got married in the first place. And now, here's the one other caveat, is that we don't get to make these decisions for ourselves. Like, I don't just get to up and declare, I declare my marriage was invalid. There is actually a church court that does that for you. It's called a marriage tribunal. So if you want to become Catholic and you want to remarry, what you do is you ask the church for a declaration of nullity. You say, would you look at my first marriage? Here are the circumstances of my first marriage. See if that marriage is actually a real marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, issue me a declaration of nullity. So now it's like I never got married. Now I can marry freely in the Catholic Church. Now, I know that's a lot to swallow. Like, I gave you a lot of distinctions, a lot of different positions. It's nuanced. I hope it made sense to you. If it didn't, I welcome, you know, any questions to clarify. Long and the short of it is, it's a pretty good chance you can remarry again if you become Catholic, but you're going to have to jump through some hoops. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, fantastic.
Billy, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you prefer to text us, you can do that. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Let's go to a beautiful part of our country, Whitefish, Montana. Here is Travis listening on KMBM. Hello, Travis. Happy Friday. What's on your mind today, sir?
And happy All Saints Day to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your show. I want to go back to the Hanukkah that you've kind of been talking about the last couple of days.
Yeah.
John 10:22, Jesus is celebrating the Feast of the Dedication, and the New American Bible footnote mentions that is Hanukkah. And I'm just kind of curious, is that kind of some of the earlier celebrations before we know the Hanukkah of today.
Yep.
It's also kind of in the back of my head, is that is also an argument for the use of the Septuagint as well, because clearly he must have had some known of the Maccabean period if he's celebrating Hanukkah or the Feast of the Dedication.
Right, yeah. So, look, I'm not an expert in Jewish ritual, okay? I'm really not, but here's what I know. So obviously the historical event of the dedication of the temple, Judas Maccabeus, is the origin of the thing. Mm-hmm. And according to Josephus, Judas instituted a celebration for the rededication of the temple. And there are some vague references in first century Tanaitic sources. There are some Mishnaic references in the second century. As far as I can tell, yeah, there is some kind of commemoration that's taking place in Jerusalem and Judea and Galilee and world Jewry in the first century. How many of the elements of a full-blown modern Hanukkah did that have? Got no idea. You know, I think there's clearly development there, but there's historical origin. In terms of the argument for the Septuagint, I don't think you need to have a Septuagint or the Deuterocanonical texts to be a first-century Jew and remember what happened to your great-grandparents.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, the Maccabean Revolt was just not that long ago. From your perspective, if you're a first-century Jew, whether or not you have written texts at your disposal. I think there are better arguments for the use of the Septuagint, and they are essentially the arguments that St. Augustine gives in his book on Christian doctrine. When asked, should Christians use the Hebrew Old Testament or the Greek Old Testament, he says they should use the Greek Old Testament because it's the ecclesiastical translation, namely, this is the one that the Catholic Church uses. It's the one the Church used.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that how do you know which books are in the Bible? I mean, ultimately, you know it from sacred tradition because it's what Catholics have been citing in sacred liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing goes, I mean, this is a canonical, it's not a translation question, it's a canon question. The church effectively used the Septuagint as its Old Testament text for purposes of sacred liturgy, and that included the Deuterocanonicals.
Travis, thanks so much for your call today. Glad that you're checking in from Whitefish, Montana. Brendan is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. He says, hi, Dr. Anders. What would you advise an atheist who wants to believe in the Catholic Church in whether they should join OCIA or not? This person is hoping the sacraments may give them the belief that they lack.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So this is a nuanced question that has a nuanced answer.
Okay.
You know, Pascal, who was one of the greatest mathematical and scientific minds of all time, and also a great religious philosopher, once wrote in the 17th century in France to an atheist who was having trouble believing. He said, here's what you do. Start having masses said and use holy water and pray the rosary and go to church and cross yourself and start doing Catholic pray-y things. And you'll find that, you know, faith comes more easily to you,
yeah.
Right? Cardinal Newman once wrote a whole book on a similar topic. It was called An Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent. And his basic thesis was that it is not argument alone, deductive reason, that tends to move people philosophically or in their, you know, their religious choices, but rather that there's a whole host of background assumptions and culture and values and intuitions and experience of the world, and people tend to accept those arguments that conform to their basic intuitions. And so the idea of being embedded in a social plausibility structure, to quote Peter Berger, definitely contributes to what we conceive of as plausible. And so hanging out with Catholics and doing Catholic things is a pretty good way to acquire a Catholic disposition towards the world.
Thanks for your question, Brendan. Lots more straight ahead on Call to Communion. Still time for your call to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open right now, and that number 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 888-3986. We'll get back to it in just a second here. Congratulations going out right now to our great EWTN radio partner, St. Gabriel Communications, serving Garden City, Kansas, celebrating 9 years with EWTN. Congratulations to James Janda and everybody there at KSGC from your friends here at EWTN. All right, back to it now for Art, listening on Sacred Heart Radio in Kentucky. Hey, Art, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, thank you guys for being on the radio.
Sure.
My question is, I believe the past Vatican II Council was the 20th Church Council of the Catholic Church. I was wondering if there was ever a gathering of bishops in a council or just a gathering of bishops that wanted to do something or believe something, and the Pope disagreed with them and said, I'm the Pope, we're going to do it my way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, happens all the time. Happens all the time. And there have been councils that have met that have put out doctrinal statements that were heretical, that have gone way off the rails. There's a famous council in church history. It's called the Robber Council.
Oh my!
Because the bad guys ran away with it, you know, and there's all kinds of crazy things that councils have done throughout history. Yeah, to be sure, and so that's why conciliar government by itself is not an adequate check on the protection of orthodoxy. Mm. It's a big help, but it's not enough. And of course, you can have divergent councils come to different agreements, different positions on key theological issues. And you got to have some way of adjudicating that. So, you know, modern Eastern Orthodoxy, for example, is split into three major branches. There's the Byzantine Orthodox, the Chalcedonian Orthodox that hold to the Council of Chalcedon. There are the Oriental Orthodox that hold to the Council of Ephesus, but not Chalcedon. And then there is the Syrian Church of the East that holds to Nicaea and Constantinople, but they reject Ephesus. And all of them think that they're the Catholic Church. All of them think that they have the right list of Orthodox councils, and all of them think that the other guys have got the wrong list. And all of them point to antiquity and to conciliar authority to bolster their position.
Mm.
And where they disagree, they simply say, well, that's where the other guy went off the rails. And there's really no way out of that conundrum unless there is a singular authoritative voice that stands outside and above the conciliar thing,
mm-hmm,
that can say, this is the valid council, this is the invalid council. And, of course, that's why, you know, the Pope can do an awful lot of crazy things. He can do an awful lot of nonsense. He can ride his horse backwards and declare war on Florence, right? He can do all kinds of nutty stuff. But at the end of the day, his job description as Pope, the fundamental thing that he does as Pope is to preserve the integrity and the unity of the Catholic faith by saying, guys, we're all going to go this way.
Yeah.
You're either with me or you're against me. And if you stay in Peter's boat, you're a Catholic. Now, you know, Peter may be a drunken sailor, but if you're in his boat, you're a Catholic, and that's the way the church is going.
Okay. Is that answering your question, Art?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. You have a good holy day.
Thank you. Thank you as well. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Ronald is a first-time caller from San Antonio, listening on the great Guadalupe Radio. Ronald, what's on your mind today, sir?
Thank you for taking my phone call. I wish you could answer a question that I've been trying to find out for a long time. I was driving in a car, my favorite station, KONO, that went off the air. So I went to FM and I got your station today. But my question is, Jesus spoke that he changed the period of time in which Satan would return to earth. And he says he shortened the time for his very elect would even be confused. Who is Jesus talking about when he says his very elect?
Yeah, when he says that the time is cut short for the sake of the elect, so the elect are those whom God knows will be saved.
Ah.
That's who the elect are in Scripture, those that God has chosen, those whom he knows will be saved.
Okay. Ronald, thanks so much for your call, and appreciate your checking in from San Antonio. And here is a question now from Eugenia. Dear Dr. Anders, in a previous program, you said that the genre of Genesis is a myth. That is true. Did you mean to say that the genre for the first 11 chapters is a myth, or that the genre for all of Genesis is a myth? Furthermore, how do we answer someone who asks us how we know that the Bible is the inspired and inerrant Word of God? Is it because Jesus quoted Scripture? Thanks, Eugenia.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the higher critical view on Genesis there's a lot of different higher critical views, but there's one that I find attractive and compelling, and it's associated with the name of a scholar named Gary Rendsburg, and he highlights the ways in which the book of Genesis seems to foreshadow the Davidic monarchy. And the internal evidence from the book suggests that the whole thing functioned as a kind of apology for, you know, a certain kind of Judean nationalism and for the Davidic monarchy in particular, by creating a story of national origins around the character of David, who's foreshadowed by characters in the book of Genesis. And before you run screaming from the room when you hear that story, interestingly, St. Augustine of Hippo, who's a doctor of the Catholic Church and not a higher critic at all, he's an ancient church father from the 4th century, said in his Confessions, the 13th book of the Confessions, that he thought the early chapters of Genesis were an allegory for the creation of the church. Now, interesting. If you read the book of Genesis, you're not going to find mention either of the character of David or of the Christian church. Right,
you know. Right, right.
Okay. Rendsburg, who's a higher critic, thinks that there are just way too many similarities between the events and characters in Genesis and events in the Davidic monarchy to be an accident, and he thinks that, you know, this is a kind of these are royal apologists that are crafting, or maybe they're relying on ancient stories and they're shaping them in the service of support of a Davidic monarch who's have a political motive here. Kind of like the story of John E. Appleseed or you know, Washington not telling a lie or chopping down the cherry tree or whatever. They're part of the national ethos, you know, create a mythos to sustain an ethos. You think that's what's going on in the composition of Genesis.
Okay, all right.
But what is the church in New Testament theology but the living fulfillment of the Davidic kingdom, which is its typology? Right, because Christ is the Davidic king.
Yeah.
He is the heir of David. And so my point is that ancient Christian allegorical readings of the Old Testament can be shown to overlay quite easily modern higher critical readings of the ancient narrative that see in it mythological elements. And that is exactly the hermeneutic, the theory of interpretation, that Pope Benedict says we should use. So when Benedict wrote, and he wrote extensively about biblical interpretation, he said what the modern Catholic interpreter should seek to do is to integrate modern higher biblical criticism, which takes the historical question very seriously and looks at things like genre and authorship and dating, right? Take all that stuff seriously, and take seriously when the church fathers say stuff like, the book of Genesis is an allegory for the creation of the church. That both those things can be true at the same time, because the church has always distinguished the literal sense is, what was the sacred author actually trying to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe like bolstering the Davidic monarchy is one of the things he had in mind. But the payout comes at the level of the spiritual interpretation. And what does that say to us today about our relationship with Christ? And St. Augustine looks at this story with its very ecclesiastical elements and says, we can find in here a picture of what it means for us to be church today in relationship to Jesus, who we find in the celebration of the liturgy, who is our Davidic king, right? And so you're asking me now a semantic question about the meaning of the word myth,
mm-hmm.
right? What I'm going to do instead is say, like, clearly in the first 11 chapters, there's something like an answer to the Enuma Elish. There's something like a response to the mythological creation stories of ancient Babylon. And the sacred authors are telling a story of the origin of the world that gives a different account from the Babylonian account that places mankind in a different position vis-a-vis the divinity, right? And the rest of the book also seems to be, a story in service of a particular national ethos, right? Now, do you want to call that myth? I mean, fine. Maybe there's another word for it. All those things can be true, and the text can still be divinely inspired and function for us where the way Catholics have always read the Bible, primarily at the spiritual level.
Okay. Eugenia, thank you so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Well, the weekend is upon us, and let me tell you about one of the great weekend shows we have cooked up for you. It is Stories from the Heart with our friend Sandra McDevitt. You can hear it Sunday mornings at 9:15 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio right after the Sunday Mass. This is a great program, Stories from the Heart, featuring Catholic inspirational stories that are uplifting and bringing the heart and soul closer to the God. Sandra is so good at this. She tells stories spanning the late 1800s to the present day. Again, Sunday morning, 9:15 a.m. Eastern, right after the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, only on EWTN Radio. All right, back to the phones now for Sarah in Pennsylvania, listening to JMJ Radio. Hello, Sarah. What's on your mind today?
Yes. Could you explain what's going on with the traditional Latin Mass movement? There are some groups that seem to have some dangerous opinions on the current Pope, the current Mass, Vatican II, and who is Marcel Lefebvre, and how should we understand him?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So what's called the traditional Latin Mass, well, you know, tradition is an ambiguous word.
It is.
The traditional Latin Mass that you would celebrate, you know, in a Latin Mass parish today is not identical in every respect to the Mass that came out of the Council of Trent in the 16th century. There, it has been updated, minor revisions over the years.
Yeah.
Right? Even most recently by Pope Paul VI. So it's not like word for word what the apostles said is my point, right? But in its larger shape, it sort of came into being in the 16th century. And the reason it came into being in the 16th century is because there was liturgical variety in late medieval Europe. And you could travel around Europe and you could find the Mass celebrated with a lot of regional variation. And when the mendicants, that is to say the Franciscans, the Dominicans, Augustinian hermits, and the like, were missionizing, and they went all over the place, when they were priests, they would carry their particular form of the Mass with them. The Dominicans actually had their own rite. They had a distinct rite. It's the Dominican rite of the Mass. It's still a legitimate Catholic rite today. So you would find liturgical texts and practices that would conform more or less to some particular religious order. And the Franciscans were the best represented. So there were, you know, the most common variant in the 16th century was the Franciscan version.
Okay.
And so when the Pope said, you know, we need to standardize the celebration of the Mass, let's take a base text that's widely familiar to people. He selected a Franciscan version of the Mass. And the Mass was diverse at that time.
Uh-huh.
And that became kind of the root text from which liturgists then went to work and composed, you know, the details of what would become the so-called traditional Latin Mass. Now, I give you that background history because it's really important to understand that the Latin Mass itself has an evolution and a development, right? And, of course, Jesus didn't say the Mass in Latin. He would have said the Mass in Aramaic. And the embellishments that grow up around the liturgy instituted by Christ are different in different cultures. So they took, you know, different forms in the West from the East. There were multiple different Latin rites. So, you know, what we call the Roman Rite of the Mass was just one rite. You have a Mozabaric rite. You have a Milanese rite. You had a Sarum rite. There were lots of different rites that emerged in the West, right? The Tridentine rite is just one of them,
Okay.
Right? So there's a diverse. And then in the East, you got Greek rites, you got Syriac rites, you got Coptic rites, you got Ethiopic rites, you got Assyrian rites, you've got Syro-Malabar rites, you have Syro-Malankar rites, you've got Russian rites. I mean, you got rites coming out your ears, right? Because as the Catholic Church grows throughout the world, the embellishments that grow up around the liturgy are culturally variable, right? I emphasize this because you don't want to have the naive position that, well, the traditional Latin masses, that's just the original mass. That's just the way it's always been. It's never been the way it's always been, right? It's beautiful. It's old. It has roots in antiquity, of course,
yeah.
Right? It's venerable, and many people have come to holiness through its celebration, right?
Okay.
Does that mean it's unassailably perfect and nothing could ever compete with it? No. There was a big movement in the 19th century called, interestingly enough, the liturgical movement. The rationale of the liturgical movement was to get lay people interested in the liturgy as such. Why would you need such a movement? Well, because the way the liturgy had often been celebrated was in a way that the lay people were largely disconnected from. And it would not have been at all uncommon, either in the late Middle Ages or even into the 20th century, to find little old Italian grandmothers that would go to Mass with their rosary beads and pray their own private prayers and devotions while the priest did his thing up at the altar, with very little concern for what was going up on the altar, except maybe for the consecration and the communion. Right? And so there was a felt need to educate people in the use of the liturgy to promote the active participation of the lay faithful, because the traditional Mass could be celebrated in a way that did not encourage the active participation of the lay faithful. Some people would have actively participated, but not all. And so that note of active participation became the key issue at the Second Vatican Council. And the document that came out of the Second Vatican Council, Sacrosanctum Concilium on the Reform of the Liturgy, said that's paramount, to promote the active participation of the lay faithful. That does not mean that the lay faithful get up at the altar and read a lot of texts. It means that they're conscious of what's going on and that they're praying and they're offering themselves along with the sacrifice of Christ. That's what the active participation of the lay faithful means. And so the reform of the liturgy that came out of the Second Vatican Council was theoretically in service of that active participation. So one of the developments made a lot of sense, was let the thing be said in the vernacular so it's more intelligible to more people.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Use a lot more scripture reading and a lot more of the Bible. And there are other developments as well.
Okay.
They actually introduced new Eucharistic prayers, but there's different ones. And it became the ordinary form of the Mass, meaning that the standard rite is the one that came out of the Second Vatican Council. So I think I've already answered the question, how should you feel about the Latin Mass? Well, it's beautiful. It's old. It's edifying. You know, it's lawful under certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the only show in town, right? And it's not like it's the one normative form that you have to do or you're a bad Catholic, right? It's never been the perfect Mass. There's always been variety in the history in Catholic liturgical tradition, and people have always come to holiness. There have been saints that have lived and died throughout the centuries and gone to heaven without ever attending one Latin Mass, right? So, you know, it's not normative for salvation. Now, you're right, there's controversy about it, because there are ideologues who maintain that the Latin Mass and the Latin Mass alone is edifying, efficacious, or even valid. And that position is false. It's a false position. And the way we know it's false is sacred tradition and the teaching of the magisterium are against it. And the popes have repeatedly said that's not true, right? It's not the only valid Mass. Archbishop Lefebvre was a French bishop who objected not only to the reform of the liturgy, but to the whole Second Vatican Council. And he established a priestly society called the Society of St. Pius X for the purpose of preserving what he saw as the traditional patrimony of the Catholic Church, the celebration of the Mass in Latin, and resistance to some of the theological developments of the Second Vatican Council. And that act was not itself schismatic or disobedient. But he wanted to ordain bishops within his society, and he had no authority to do so, and the Pope forbade him to do so. Pope John Paul II said, you may not ordain bishops to your society. And Lefebvre did it anyway, and he got himself excommunicated and got all of his bishops excommunicated. And that society still exists today. The excommunications have been lifted, and that was a unilateral act of generosity on the part of the Pope in a hopes of reconciling those folks. They do not possess any jurisdiction in the Catholic Church or any canonical status. They operate outside of direct obedience to the Holy Father, and they're in a deuce of a position, if you ask me. And so that's, and they're among those ideologues that I mentioned.
Does that answer your question, Sarah?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Bill in Southern California, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Bill, happy feast day to you. What's on your mind today, sir?
Quick question. I know we're running out of time here. And based on Dr. Anders' excellent early discussion, it really helped me understand a lot about imputed righteousness. I was a Protestant for most of my life and became Catholic, largely thanks to Dr. Anders. Here's the question. Can the Protestant view of imputed righteousness open the door to a risk of laxity in regards to moral development and deportment?
Of course it can. Of course it can. Now, but although that's true, I have to say that I grew up among Protestants. And the Protestants who raised me and who taught me and mentored me were some of those moral, decent people I've ever known. And, you know, I had a Southern Baptist grandfather who would roll over in his grave if he knew I'd become Catholic, who was one of the finest people I ever met in my entire life. I mean, he wouldn't have known moral laxity if it beat him over the head with a cannonball, right? I mean, he was a fine man of incredible integrity. My father, raised a Southern Baptist, became a Presbyterian, was a Presbyterian elder, never known a finer man in my life, you know, was a moral exemplar to all those around him. My mother, God bless her, she's still living. Just an absolute trooper, wonderful woman to whom I owe my life and so many good things. Have nothing but the highest respect for my parents, my ancestors, many of my Protestant teachers, friends, and mentors. Fine, fine moral people, better than I'll ever be. So if I say that the doctrine of imputed righteousness can tend to moral laxity, I do not want to suggest in the slightest that it necessarily always does so. Now, and a Protestant, except for some radical antinomians, most Protestants would tell you that if a Protestant used imputed righteousness to justify moral laxity, then they should call their own salvation into question. Because the justified soul in Protestant theology is also the regenerate soul, and the regenerate soul loves righteousness and hates sin. And so if you love sin and hate righteousness, they'd say it's probably not a legitimate faith that you're relying on for your salvation. Now, you know, I think there's all kinds of problems with that position in terms of internal logic, but the fact of the matter is that Protestants would not countenance antinomianism, and even Luther wrote sermons and essays against antinomianism, which is this moral laxity that you're talking about. And although the Catholic Church clearly teaches that moral laxity is wrong, 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 it is possible to make a superstitious use of the sacrament of penance to justify moral laxity, right? So there are Catholics who are morally lax and rely upon a misinterpretation of their own tradition to justify that laxity. Protestants can, of course, do the same thing, and if they're going to do that, then they would use justification by faith as a justification for their antinomianism. So, answer to your question, yes. Does not mean Protestants are immoral people. Did you hear me say that, Pastor
yes.
Fred? Pastor Fred's always writing me. Did not say they're immoral people. Very good people, better people than I am. But yes, that antinomianism has always been a temptation for sola fideists. And that's why Luther attacked it in the 16th century, because he recognized that could be a misinterpretation of his doctrine.
Very good. Bill, thanks so much for your call and for your kind words about the program. Fast-moving show here today. Dr. David Anders, a happy feast day to you, sir.
You too, Tom.
Thank you so much. Don't forget, if you haven't been, it is a holy day of obligation, or as I like to say, a holy day of opportunity. Coming up next on many of these EWTN stations, it's Open Line Friday with our friend Colin Donovan. He answers your questions on theology. That's coming up next on most of these EWTN radio stations. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. We hope that you have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you in here on Monday on next week's editions of Catholic Call to Communion. Until then, have a wonderful weekend and God bless.